Welcome to the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to start off today with a joint memorial, open up a public hearing on HJM 25. Linda?
Certainly. House Joint Memorial 25 urges Congress to reauthorize the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act of 2000 and to appropriate funding at the 2008 levels for an additional 10-year period through 2021.
Okay. Gil and your team?
We're awaiting Senator Morris and some necessary paperwork for the other bills before us today.
It should be here before the time's up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Gil Riddell, Association of Boarding Counties. I'm accompanied by Commissioner Sid Lykin of Lane County and will be accompanied shortly, I hope, by Commissioner Craig Pope of Polk County, who's also concerned about the memorial for the late Commissioner Mike Probst in some other... Oh, here he is. Thank you. I'll just make a couple of introductory remarks and then turn it over to these two gentlemen who will address the real-world importance of this federal legislation. The Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act has been called the Federal Force Payments Law or the County Payments Law, but it is appropriate to be here in the Education Committee because SRS has accounted for some $60 million biennium of revenues for K through 12. The details of probable outcomes of the expiration of Secure Rural Schools was provided by the Governor's Task Force on Federal Force Payments and County Services in its report in January 2009. Bottom line is county schools and the state will feel the pain. Before you, I have a document labeled SRS Primer, and you get a glance at the hits on county budgets beginning at the bottom of page 2. And some of those figures are pretty dramatic. We have a national campaign, the Campaign for Rural America. It has many stakeholders and a deeply committed Oregon congressional delegation. As far as stakeholders, I want to give a shout-out to the Oregon Farm Bureau, who with the Mississippi Farm Bureau got the National Farm Bureau to list this as one of their national priorities, reauthorization of Secure Rural Schools. HJM 25 is symbolic, but since Oregon receives over 50% of the money, we urge you to send this on to the Senate floor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee. I'm here today to give my testimony in support of this House Joint Memorial. And I want to let you know that I've engaged since the start of my term here this year with Associated Oregon Counties, NACO, and the committee or the campaign in D.C. to get this reauthorization in place. And we've been pushing hard to get this done at the 2008 funding levels. I can tell you in Polk County, we've lost a substantial amount of income over the years from our loss of timber revenues, of course, and desperately need this funding to maintain just basic services. We lost about $800,000 in this budget cycle this year. We're going to lose another over $1 million in next year's budget cycle. We are laying off road deputies now. We've laid off one corrections officer in the jail. Next year, we'll be laying off more. Unfortunately, that's just the beginning of it. We have a great deal to lose here for the minimal amount of services we're able to support in Polk County, and I would urge you to support this and move it forward. I think all Oregonians need this to happen, and certainly the timber counties need your help here. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sid Lykin. I serve as the Lane County Board of Commissioners. And in fact, I was just sworn in January, but I'm here to voice support for House Joint Memorial 25. As what My fellow commissioner mentioned how important this is, I think, to the timber-dependent counties. This measure essentially is a letter to Congress, and it's urging them to renew and extend the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act. This piece of federal legislation provides funding for Oregon's counties in absence of the federal revenue once realized from the sale of timber off Oregon's federal lands. And I just want to point out as well, before I was sworn in as a Lane County Commissioner, I served as the mayor of the city of Springfield for 10 years. And one of the things that's mentioned in here and that's very important, I think, to our local communities has been the issue of road funds. And one of the examples I like to use is we have a project in Springfield that essentially used about $5.5 million of road funds and an equal to $500 million high-tech regional hospital in our city. And so I think when you talk about the opportunities for leverage of what these funds bring to local communities, it creates jobs, it creates opportunities, I think, for all of our citizens. But when you're looking at our budget process right now, as we're looking currently in Lane County, we're looking at a 10% cut. And it's to crucial areas, in particular in public safety. And when you're looking to reduce or eliminate rural patrol in Lane County, which, of course, as many know, Lane County is roughly the size of Connecticut, that becomes, I think it causes awareness for many folks. The larger cities, Eugene and Springfield, that's something that we can continue to handle with our police force. But when you look at the rural areas of Lane County, I think there's some real issues of public safety that come into play. And as Butch mentioned is before, I think what's important here is the grassroots level and what we have. And again, I'll just reiterate, the partnership for ruralamerica.org is a website. I would just urge you to look at it. I'm really pleased that we have such strong support from our federal delegation. But I think having strong support from our state sends a good solid message back to Washington, D.C. So again, I thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you.
And thank you for traveling up here and testifying on this. Can you update us, maybe you know better, on this, where things stand back there?
Mr. Chair, we have some good news. It's mixed, though. The president put a marker in his proposed budget for this without detailing an amount, and it is, but it is specified to be a, I think, 4 or 5 years at a declining amount. So that's not sufficient, but it does open the door. The House Budget Committee mentioned it as a priority. We still need offsets to find offsets for it on the federal budget under the cut-go rules, but but it gives us, as a priority, it gives us a broader field to look for those offsets. We're not limited to particular categories of spending. We have Greg Walden in the leadership in the House. That will be critical. The Senate doesn't have pay-go rules, and, of course, we have two champions out of Oregon, Senators Merkley and Wyden, and they're working very hard on this. So, as I say, it's going to be difficult, but we're pitched in the battle.
Questions, Senator George?
Gentlemen, obviously I'm very supportive of this proposal, but I kind of take a step back a little bit. In all the history I've read on the issue of federally owned or publicly owned lands, the idea was that each state came into the union on equal footing. So you mentioned Connecticut in comparison. Connecticut's about 99% privately owned.
Uh-huh.
As you come through the West, we weren't settling it fast enough, and so the lands were put into public trust with the assumption that they would be eventually put in private hands where they would create private revenues through property taxation. That never happened. The exchange is that in lieu of paying property taxes, because it was being held in public lands, that the activities on the public lands would create revenues, which they did for generations. Tens of thousands of Oregonians had family wage jobs, supporting the community. I believe Douglas County had $200 million come to the state and local governments directly from cutting of the public lands. The federal government got $200 million out of Douglas County in revenues. All that's gone now, pretty much, for the most part. At the end of the day, we're now stuck in this situation where the federal government's made this decision not to cut land that's in the state of Oregon. But now they still don't pay property taxes. And now we're going back on bended knees asking them for some charity for land that they're not paying property taxes on. So, sort of from an open debate process, it seems like to me that we as the state of Oregon ought to send them a property tax bill to support our schools and our local governments, because it's literally in the billions of dollars that our schools aren't getting by lost property tax revenue. And if they're not going to use the asset that they have, then they should pay up. I know that sounds ridiculous, but to me, it's a fundamental equal protection between us and other states. We're being forced to maintain an infrastructure in this state when the property taxes aren't being paid to maintain that infrastructure. So I know that sounds ridiculous, but I mean, has anybody ever looked at the idea of basically saying to the federal government, "This, we're not asking for charity here. You either pay up or we're going to take your property back."
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's you've hit the nub of the issue. And yes, they have heard that from us. Maybe not in those exact words, but we want them to acknowledge that they entered into a partnership with schools and counties here, and that they've got to be a good neighbor. The problem goes beyond just not paying property taxes. They're not taking care of their lands, and the lands are being overstocked, threatened for wild. There's a threat of wildfires, which we would have to put out. They're just not being good neighbors, and I think your sentiment is accurate.
I think I heard a floor speech in that question of yours.
You may get a priority bill.
So do you have a bill?
I may.
A bill for a bill.
Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I have Dave Barrow signed up here, but I don't see him. And I have Morgan Allen signed up here, but did you sign up for this bill?
Free taxes. Okay. You don't care.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Oregon School Board Association. I'll be very brief. We support the memorial, and this has been a priority for our board. As recently as this February, our board and our president of our association went out to D.C., and we talked to all seven of our congressional members, both our senators and our five representatives, and this is one of the three issues that we brought up for K-12 education. And I'd briefly just say, you know, although the money directly impacts the schools and the counties that receive that money, it counts as local revenue, and our state school funding formula takes into account not only the $5.7 billion that this legislature has already allocated to K-12, but all that local revenue gets into that calculation. So when, you know, some school district in Jackson County loses their timber money, that means that more of that $5.7 million goes to equalize the schools in Jackson County. So all kids in Oregon lose when we lose the secure rural schools money. So that's just a point I wanted to bring, and the K-12 community is very supportive of this, and we appreciate the work that our colleagues and friends at the counties have done, and just wanted to add our voice to the support of the memorial and this effort.
No, that's an excellent point. Thank you for bringing it. This affects everybody in the state, not just rural roads, rural cops. Anyone else wishing to testify on this memorial? Then I'm going to close a public hearing on HJM 25 and open up a work session on HJM 25.
Mr. Chair, I move House Joint Memorial 25 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves House Joint Memorial 25 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. House Joint Memorial 25 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator George, would you like to carry this?
The adjutant's wanting to. I may go a little further than what they want to do.
Mr. Chair, their list just came back.
I just love Senator George's floor speeches.
Yeah. Well,
I'm tired.
We already heard it. We heard a preview. I'd like to open up a hearing on House Bill 2939. Representative Gelser is here.
I don't need that.
Okay. Then let me call up Chris Shank and Kirsten Maroney.
While they're coming up. House Bill 2939 prohibits use of mechanical restraint, chemical restraint, or prone restraint on students in public education programs. It does allow the use of physical restraint or seclusion on students in public education programs under specific circumstances, describes the procedures to be followed if restraint or seclusion is used, and requires preparation of an annual report related to the use of physical restraint or seclusion, directs the Department of Education to approve training programs in physical restraint and seclusion that meet Department of Human Services standards.
Okay. Thank you for joining us. Just start off with your ID. And
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Chris Schenk. I am a staff attorney with Disability Rights Oregon. We are the protection and advocacy agency for the state of Oregon, and in that role, we advocate on behalf of children on their special education and civil rights. Over the years, we've received many calls from parents with concerns about excessive and improper use of restraint and seclusion on their children during the school day. In response, we urged the Department of Education to adopt administrative rules on the issue. Those came into effect in 2007, and we were really hopeful that they would address a lot of the concerns that we had been hearing about. However, we continue to receive calls from parents with very sad stories and big concerns about their child's safety. Because we were receiving those calls, we decided to take a closer look at how the rules were really working. We gathered information from across the state, from districts and from parents, and that information is summarized for you in the report that you're receiving, Keep Schools Safe for Everyone. Basically, 3.5 years after the rules went into effect, it's pretty clear that they don't provide adequate protection to keep all students and staff safe in our schools. As we gathered the information, we had some concerns that kind of rose to the top as our greatest concerns. Number one, it appears that Oregon has a really high rate of restraint and seclusion. The current rules require districts to have a process for conducting an annual review. Very few of the districts are actually conducting those reviews. In fact, out of 197 districts in the state, only 37 of them were able to give us data from their annual review about how often restraint and seclusion was used in their district. Based on the limited numbers that we did get, it looks like Oregon has a very high rate per capita when we compare it to states like California and Texas. We have concerns about the number of students who are experiencing repeated restraints and seclusions. I worked with a student this fall who was restrained or secluded 30 times in the first 2 months of school. That's more than every other day. He's an 8-year-old kid, and that's a frightening number. We're alarmed by the number of very young students who are experiencing restraint and seclusion for exceedingly long periods of time. 75% of the restraints and seclusions that happen in Oregon happen to the youngest kids. We've worked with 6-year-old students who are being held in seclusion rooms for 2 to 3 hours at a time. The doors held shut by their teachers. And we get calls on a regular basis from parents of students who had toileting accidents during seclusion because they were not allowed access to the bathroom. We're concerned that parents aren't getting information that they need to make good educational decisions for their child. Right now, the rules require that parents receive some notice that a restraint or a seclusion happened, but what that often looks like is a call from the school, your child had a hard day today, and we had to restrain them. And they don't know whether that was for 2 minutes or for 2 hours, and they don't know what led up to the incident. They don't know how it was resolved. For parents to make really good decisions about educational choices for their child, they need more information. We're also concerned that the current rules don't regulate prone restraint, mechanical restraint, or chemical restraint. These types of restraints are particularly dangerous. A prone restraint is when a student is held face down on the floor in a laying down position. In other states, we have seen students die in the course of a prone restraint because it's a type of restraint that can restrict a student's breathing. That hasn't happened in Oregon. We want to make sure that it doesn't. I got a call just this week from a mom who went to go pick up her daughter at school and found her face down on the floor in a prone restraint. We'd like to express our strong support for the passage of this bill because it addresses each of those concerns. It prohibits the use of prone restraint, mechanical restraint, and chemical restraint, and it does allow for physical restraint and seclusion if a student is posing a reasonable threat of imminent serious bodily injury to himself or herself or others. And it provides reasonable safeguards for any restraint that lasts for more than 30 minutes, including access to the bathroom and water. It gives parents the information that they need to make good educational decisions for their child. They'll get detailed notice of incidents that occur, and they'll be immediately notified if a restraint or seclusion has lasted for longer than 30 minutes. And it creates a meaningful and transparent annual review process for districts to engage in. It tells them really what they should be looking at, and it requires that all that information be made available to the public. So while we had a lot of concerns come up during the course of our work, we also had reason to find hope. Many of the students that we work with were being restrained and secluded on an ongoing basis. We found that when their teachers and staff received proper supports and training, they were able to learn behavior management techniques, and they could in turn teach the students behavior management techniques so that behavior could be diffused before it reached the point where somebody had to be held down or put in a seclusion room. We also have hope because there's a district in our state that has achieved success in reducing the number of restraints and seclusions. The McMinnville School District conducted an annual review in 2007-2008, and they found across the district there had been 72 restraints. They decided that they could do better than that, and the following year they put into place more training and more supports. In 2008-2009, that number of 72 restraints had been cut back to just 9. The district attributes that 84% reduction in their restraint and seclusion rate to staff development. They taught staff how to identify when a student was starting to feel anxious, when they were having sensory integration issues, and they taught them early intervention techniques to de-escalate behavior before it reached the point where your only choice is to put a kid into a restraint or into a seclusion room. We feel really confident that other districts can achieve that same level of success. We believe that House Bill 2939 will give them the tools and the encouragement to achieve that success, and we hope for your support. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you. I'll refer to you in the whole question.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Kirsten Maroney, and I'm here today to talk to you about my daughter, Brooke, who is a 16-year-old with significant disabilities who's been in the special education system since she was a baby. Brooke is a teenager with autism who enjoys many of the things typical teenagers enjoy, running and being active and exploring her environment. The types of educational approaches that work well for children with autism have always worked well for my daughter. Picture communication, exchange systems, applied behavioral analysis, certain approaches that have kind of a long history of success for children with autism. Her lifelong fascination with elevators really became an issue for her teachers when she entered high school. When she was in elementary and middle school, she was in buildings that did not have elevators. But because she's obsessed with elevators, when she made it into the high school, she became aware of the elevator in the building and became a problem for staff because she would want to run out of the classroom, go to the elevator, and then make it very difficult to get her back into the room. And I understood that the school was having problem with this issue because we have the same problem when we take her out into the community. It's a real issue. So we met when she began high school. The teacher had kind of an emergency meeting with some of the paraeducators in the room and administrators and I to address this issue of her running out of the classroom, and we agreed that for the purpose of transitioning her in the building, it would be okay to have her in a wheelchair with basically a seatbelt in a wheelchair to move her in the building from, you know, the classroom to adaptive PE or to a place where she'd receive some physical or occupational therapy. And it specifically stated in her IEP that the chair would be used for transitions. And it was with my consent that, you know, as a team, we agreed that this was an appropriate solution for dealing with this issue of running out of the classroom. That was her freshman year of high school. And then, as you know, the state budget crisis worsened, and there was significant staffing decrease in her classroom. I didn't exactly know what was going on, but beginning Brooke's sophomore year of high school, she, because she's nonverbal, I don't understand, you know, she's not able to tell me exactly what's going on, but for the first time in her life, really, she was refusing to get on the school bus, having big fits about having to go to school, was clearly very unhappy, and I had to get to the bottom of it because she's nonverbal. This was such unusual behavior. I knew that there was something terribly wrong. After several conversations with her teacher, I learned that the staffing had really impacted the classroom. There were quite a bit more students and fewer staff there to manage them. And the issue of Brooke running out of the room to visit the elevator was, you know, a major issue without enough staff in the classroom. So the goals and things that were listed in her IEP weren't really being addressed, again, because of the staffing crisis and the inability to kind of access the kinds of educational approaches that had been successful with her in the past. The teachers, you know, told me all this and said, you know, what I really needed to do was kind of advocate strongly for more staff in the classroom, that this would improve the situation. So I tried desperately through letters and phone calls and emails to the administrators in the building, to the head of special education, to other people in the main office of Portland Public Schools, but I was not successful, and I was told that because of the budget, there would be no more staffing for the classroom. I became very frustrated. I had a friend who was a paraeducator in the classroom with Brooke, who had been laid off with the staffing crisis, who went back to visit the classroom and told me in confidence that when she went into the classroom, Brooke was basically tied into that wheelchair that was meant to be her transition chair for most of the school day. She had a large Velcro strap around her waist and fastened in the back. She had both of her feet strapped to the wheelchair pedal, and she was spending the entire school day in this wheelchair with an electronic toy in her lap, pushing the buttons and making the sounds instead of working on her IEP goals. I didn't believe it. I couldn't imagine that this was happening without my consent. I was sure that, you know, this couldn't be happening. And I was very upset. I contacted my state caseworker through the Department of Human Services. And she said, well, she explained to me that I needed to contact Disability Rights Oregon and ask for their advocacy, that the type of restraint that they were doing actually technically wasn't against the law. That when Brooke was in middle school and they would restrain her physically by holding her and keeping her from running where she wanted to go, that I would be notified of that restraint, but the type of restraint where she's strapped into a chair was completely legal and there was no notification of that going on. Once I found out that this was happening, I made an unannounced visit to the classroom to see if it was true. Again, I did not want to believe it. And when I walked into the classroom, that was exactly the case. My daughter was tied into a chair and being ignored in the corner of the classroom with an electronic toy in her lap. I asked her teacher, what can we do to remedy the situation? I don't think that this is an appropriate place for my child to be during the school day. And she I wanted her to tell me directly, how many hours is she spending in this chair? And she wouldn't give me a direct answer, but she said things like, well, there are times like in adaptive PE when, you know, she's taken to the gym and she's allowed out of her chair for about 30 minutes, that she's not in her chair. And I think it would be a great idea to add less chair time as one of her goals. And I couldn't believe that she had said that to me, that it was now the norm that my child would be strapped in the chair all school day. So I became quite upset. I enlisted the advocacy of Disability Rights Oregon, their presence at the meetings with Brooke's team and the school's administrators did result in a positive outcome for Brooke. Because of what happened, I really strongly advocated to have her in a different classroom. She is now in a classroom in a building with an elevator, and she is able to move, even transition in the building now without the elevator. It's all those educational approaches that worked well for her when she was young that they didn't have the staff to do when she was in another situation. When they employ those strategies, particularly those autism strategies, they're able to manage her without using a restraint at all. They did use the restraint for transitions at first, but now she, you know, walks to the lunchroom, she walks to her different classrooms, all without a restraint. She even took a field trip to the Clackamas Town Center without her chair at all. They left the chair at school. So they rarely use the chair. It's been, you know, hugely successful, and she hasn't changed. She's the same person who was strapped in the chair all day in school, and now she's, you know, enjoying an educational experience where she's not restrained all day. And the only thing that changed was the way the staff kind of managed her. I do believe that parents deserve to know when their child is being restrained, especially for the length of time my child was restrained. And I strongly support this bill, and I hope that after hearing her story, you will help to lend a voice to children like my daughter who cannot tell you this for themselves. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bonaventure.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I have a question I believe probably best directed to Ms. Schenck. I have a correspondence from the Director of Special Education at Beaverton School District, who was concerned about forcing the districts to collect data and report it to the Department of Education. It's my understanding, I just want to get this on the record, that that part, the reporting part of this bill, has been taken out. So if you could just clarify that on the record and talk a little bit about whether this would create an additional burden for districts. I'd just like to get that clarified on the record. Thank you.
Chair Hess and Senator Bonamici, the requirement to report the data to the Oregon Department of Education has been taken out of this bill.
Thank you.
Section 4 and 5 of my version does require some reporting. What's the enforcement mechanism?
Chair Hess, so the districts do need to collect the data, and then they would make it available to the public.
Just a disclosure.
Exactly.
And if they don't, or if they fall into the ditch on that, then what's their recourse?
Chair Hess, we had some provisions in the bill that would have oversight by the Department of Education. Those have been taken out at this point. Our agency will definitely be keeping an eye on the issue and hopefully collecting data from the districts that are compiling it.
Okay. Further questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on this? Okay, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2939. And we have some housekeeping to do on 2283 and 2285. So let me open up a work session on House Bill 2283. Senator Morris, you need to be the person to make the, to rescind the amendment.
Are we rescinding the bill first?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I'm going to start with 83.
Yes. We're in work session on 2283.
Mr. Chair, I move to rescind the Dash 3 amendments adopted by the committee on May 10th with respect to House Bill 2283A.
Senator Morris moves to rescind the Dash 3 amendments adopted May 10th, 2011. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Are we doing the Dash 6s?
On this, yes, there is a Dash 6.
Okay, ready to move on the Dash 6.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2283, dated 5/11/11.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the A6 amendment, dated May 11, 2011, to House Bill 2283. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none. So ordered. And so now on to the bill.
Yes, we can move the measure. We do have the fiscal.
We do have the fiscal
mm-hmm.
and the paperwork necessary.
Correct, we do.
Are you ready to go?
We're ready to go.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2283 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves House Bill 2283 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 2283 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Morris, would you like to carry this bill?
Certainly.
Closed work session on Senate Bill 2283 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 2285. We have the same.
Are we good to go?
We are good.
Yes,
to go.
We are.
Mr. Chair, I move to rescind the House Bill with the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2285 adopted on May 10th.
Senator Morris moves to rescind the House Bill 2285-3 amendments adopted on May 10th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, any objection?
Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2285, dated May 11, 2011.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated May 11, 2011 to House Bill 25. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2285 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves House Bill 2285 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 2285 moves to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Shields, would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we'll use them for the rules.
If you wish to move 2939, open the work session on that and move that to the floor.
I'm going to wait for Suzanne to get back. Back on Thursday.
If she's gone for the thing. Okay, we can right. Carry it over again.
We'll carry over House Bill 2939 mm-hmm. to Tuesday. See no other business before us. We are adjourned.